Buy my soda, said the moose diarrhea salesman. And we did. We all did. But when we brought it home and opened it, it was not what we thought we were getting. And instead of searching for something better, we settled for searching for another moose diarrhea salesman. I remember how disappointed I was when my family brought home our first TV. It wasn't because it was black and white, but when you turned the TV on, President Kennedy wasn't on the screen. See, when we first went to the store to buy the TV, President Kennedy was there, in color, row after row of his head, all the way up to the ceiling. Look, Eric, it's President Kennedy. See, it's President Kennedy. Hi, President Kennedy! I toilet trained late. On June 17th, 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court gave me the best birthday present a five-year-old kid could ask for. They outlawed prayer in public schools right before I started kindergarten. On November 22nd, 1963, President Kennedy's brains were blown apart on national television. I came in from the yard and saw my mom crying on the couch. What did I do this time? I'd already made her cry once that day. Later, in that same living room, Lee Harvey Oswald was gunned down right before my eyes, and again on the instant replays. The funeral dirge played on, and the flag-draped coffin lingered on the black and white screen day after day as people filed past it to say goodbye. Even I sensed this was a sad, heavy moment. I was upset, too. I wondered if cartoons would ever come back. I liked cartoons, followed at 6 by NBC News. I watched both with equal fascination. My favorite cartoon characters at the time were Bullwinkle and Senator Everett Dirksen. Even then, I was a news hound, alive at a crucial time, alert to what I saw and what my family chose not to hide. If I asked them what a race riot was, they'd tell me. If I asked them, Daddy, what's Vietnam? They'd tell me. But I was terrified of going to Taos, New Mexico over spring vacation. I was afraid I might run into some greasy Mexican Frito Banditos there, with bullet belts and big hats who'd sneer at me as they leaned against what I knew was going to be grimy buildings. They might grab me and run off with me like I'd seen them do on cowboy shows. I was all for Negro civil rights. But when I saw in My Weekly Reader that Native American Indians wanted rights too, I couldn't believe it. How dare they ask for rights after all the trouble they caused on Daniel Boone? I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, about 4 miles from the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant. Only time will tell what that did to my brain. In first grade, on the playground, we'd play war. Sometimes even I joined the pack of boys all chasing one kid called the Jap all over the playground yelling, "Eh!" A lot of times the Jap was the only Vietnamese kid in our grade. He seemed feisty, not very friendly, and hid in the bushes a lot. I never heard of God till about third grade. The same year I had to stay after school one day and write over and over again, "I will not laugh during flag pledge. I will not laugh during flag pledge." Even my mom's still laughing over that one. At home, my dad would read us Greek, Roman, and Egyptian mythology as bedtime stories, and I had a choice to discover and decide on my own whether or not to believe in gods. That summer, on a family vacation, my dad drove me through the Detroit ghetto to show me up close why people get mad and start riots. It was exciting. We went to a big city, I saw the Henry Ford Car Museum, and I finally got to see some real slums. By the time we got back to my grandparents' place on the other side of Michigan, Detroit was on fire, and my grandparents had a color TV. Vietnam blew up in everyone's face. By fifth or sixth grade, everyone at my school knew who at school was for and against the war. The smiling storybook policeman was now a symbol of violent brutality and hate, especially after my dad came home from a trip saying an L.A. cop had stuck a shotgun in his belly. When he came out to ask why they were blocking the entrance to the place he was trying to run a social work conference at in Santa Barbara, California, he said the cop was shaking as much as he was. Anti-war protests were a regular event across the street from my elementary school at the University of Colorado, somewhere I still have my souvenir student strike band. I was one of the first kids in my school to have long hair. Paid for it, too. Somewhere around then was when my parents quit buying Coors beer. One night, one of my mother's student employees at the university library showed up at the front door of our house, frightened out of his wits that he was about to get picked up by the cops as a draft dodger and sent to prison. I was the only one home. Then, one spring morning, my sixth grade teacher had the gall to start off the class by praising the National Guard for shooting four student protesters to death at Kent State. Something inside me snapped. Something inside me said, "This will not stand. This will not stand." Not for me, anyway. Not now, not ever. To rub it in, they forced us to sing almost all patriotic songs in the spring music program that year. I had a weapon, though. I was the worst singer in the class. The one who had to stand up and sing, "And the rocket's red glare," over and over again in front of the entire class, as if humiliating me would somehow get me to sing our national anthem and all those corny Christmas jingles on key. At least I did it my way. In seventh grade geography class, there was a long, detailed unit on Soviet communist propaganda techniques. How their government chose people's careers. How they manipulated the masses through billboard slogans and slanted news reporting that didn't even bother to tell people what they didn't want people to know. How their school books rewrote history, said a Russian invented the light bulb. So then when I got to eighth grade, I thought, I wonder if some of these same propaganda techniques are in the American history books, too. And sure enough, they were! Columbus discovered America. Eurocentric land grab speculators and religious fanatics came to visit and decided to stay to make the so-called New World civilized. It was bad enough finding out there wasn't a Santa Claus. Then I found out George Washington owned slaves. That such patriotic heroes as John Hancock and Samuel Adams were by modern definition terrorists. That our country was founded by agribusiness plantation pot growers who didn't feel like paying taxes, if that sounds familiar. That those pilgrims with the Guns N' Roses hats we drew pictures of in elementary school before every Thanksgiving were as wacko as Pat Robertson and later gave us the Salem witch trials. That Father Sarah and the conquistadores and the Yankee cavalry weren't so civilized towards the natives after all. Did a Russian invent the light bulb? How will we ever know? Much later, I got a hold of some old issues of Fortune magazine from 1941, early in the year, long before Pearl Harbor, and it was chock full of state-of-the-art full-page ads from those same global corporations we know and love today, bragging about all the money they were going to make when America entered World War II. Then later I hear that General Motors helped supply both the Allies and the Nazis, then sued the American government after the war for bombing their munitions factory in Dresden, and won. When I was 15, starting high school, I got called into the counselor's office.
"Eric, it's time for us to sit down and plan your career."
"What? I'm only 15. What about exploring? What about adventure? What about life? I don't want a career. I hate work."
"But Eric, look. We have a special hookup to the big computer out at the sprawling IBM factory in scenic Niwot, Colorado. You just tell the computer your skills. Do you have any hobbies, Eric? Tell it what you think you might actually be able to stomach doing the rest of your life in an age when meaningful work is a luxury. And the computer will choose your career for you." Cool.
So I tried my sincere best and entered in my life story, my interests, said I liked theater, broadcasting, forensics, music, you know, all the cool classes that are now getting cut because people are too busy spending their kids' inheritances to pay the taxes to support them. I was good at English, social studies, maybe math. And the computer, as computers did in those days, clinkety, 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 clinked for a while, and eventually spat back that I should spend my high school years preparing to be a dental hygiene assistant. With a life like that to look forward to, I guess I should stick to daydreaming. That great sin of the American education system that I first got yelled at for in second grade. Daydreaming of a far-off Walter Mitty Cinderella ambition like starting a band. But that's just a dream. Because this is the 1970s. The sober, stupid, boring 70s that only a bonehead would want to bring back any part of in any form. When we were coming of age, we weren't dazed and confused. We were disgusted. We missed the 60s. All that fire mellowed out, paved over into what we now call yuppies. And rock and roll had been reduced to a spectator sport. When the so-called alternative scene that people take for granted today didn't exist. Punk rock didn't exist. Garage bands and independent records were unheard of. In Colorado, you either sounded as horrible as the Eagles or you didn't play. Music was for special people. Beautiful people with connections who could all play as good as Jimmy Page. Sometimes people ask me, "How can you remember all this stuff? How could I forget? How could anyone forget?" It makes me really sad and a little alarmed when someone my age I haven't seen in years tells me that I remember more of their own childhood than they do. That they have no tangible personal memories of Vietnam or even Watergate. We were 16 then. It was on everybody's lips. Senator Sam and those hearings were the best soap opera all summer. But no, sometimes they'll tell me, "I don't remember much of anything from back then. I guess I had a bad childhood or something." But then if I start humming a TV commercial no one's heard in decades, bing! They recognize it instantly. That's scary. On my 14th birthday, future sham cult figure G. Gordon Liddy and his CIA renegade friends were caught red-handed in the Watergate apartments, breaking into the Democrats' headquarters in what was supposedly a clean election in what is supposedly a free country. Burnt out from fighting against Vietnam or not, people fought back. We were pissed. But did we learn? Did we remember? Contragate is worse, and it's still with us. Government dope dealing, Inslaw, Iraqgate, BCCI, the mask is off again. This time, we embrace the face. I wonder why these things just don't register anymore. Few years ago, I couldn't even get myself kicked out of jury duty by wearing a Millions of Dead Cops t-shirt to court every single day. Nowadays, people are asleep. Nowadays, we've let ourselves be programmed to believe that figure skaters' knees and a Marine's missing weenie are bigger, more important scandals than the $250 billion banking swindle still going on while our rotting neo-banana republic is cracking apart at the seams for all to see. Programmed to believe that everything from immigrants of a different skin color to Snoop Doggy Dog are more responsible for tearing apart our social fabric than conniving greedy Republicans. It ain't the fault of the Japanese or even Tanya Harding that our hijacked, unconstitutional government of the people by corporations for corporations must be overthrown. Somewhere out there is what the late folk singer Phil Oakes once called the real America. I agree that there is something in this land, in us, that is worth trying to hang on to. I repeat, the 90s may not be pleasant, but they sure as hell ain't boring. Buy my soda, said the Moose Diarrhea salesman.